All right, it's time to get started and then some. So need to get over here to the book of Genesis and get started. I want to thank Richard Watson for teaching last week. Richard's my favorite substitute teacher, I guess is a good way to describe him. And understand he had a real interesting class last week and everything. And that I appreciate the fact that he covered so much of that material that was there in chapters 2, and we're ready to head beyond chapter 3 after we look at two or three things in chapter 3. Sometimes in a class situation, a situation develops like, where'd the devil come from? Does it really make any difference? I mean, you stop and think about it. You know, I love Deuteronomy 29:29. At one time, I could have told you exactly where he came from, okay? But there are some things. I mean, like the word Lucifer being applied to the devil. You study the one time Lucifer appears in the Bible, and you'd never decide unless somebody told you ahead of time that it was the devil. And so here's all of this Catholic dogma that talks about where the devil came from. That's not biblical dogma. And Satan led a rebellion of the angels in heaven, and that's where all of this came from. Well, were there angels that were rebellious? Yes. Is there any indication that Satan led that rebellion? Nope, not at all. You know, and so sometimes when it gets over to that matter, I have a very strong opinion about where the devil came from, okay? But does it really, really make it any difference? Now then, on the other hand, I'm glad when we study the Bible, we get intense about it. I really, really am glad, aren't you? It would just be so amazing. I just came back from Fried Hardeman, and they have there every afternoon what they call the Open Forum. And it's a pretty exciting time. You're talking about getting two or 3,000 preachers together and asking a Bible question. Guess how many opinions you have, you know? And I don't know if you have 2,000 or 3,000, but man, everybody that comes to the mic really, really feels strongly about it and everything. So, and I'm glad. I'm thankful that we feel strongly about what the Bible teaches and all of those things. And so, I enjoy answering questions on first Sunday night because it's an indication of the fact somebody's been studying the Bible. Those questions are not things that somebody just, hasn't given any thought to. Somebody's been reading a verse in the Bible and said, I don't have a clue what this verse is all about. And so you do have all of that. Can I read two verses of Scriptures that I believe helps understand where the devil came from? Now, having read all of these, that doesn't answer the question about the rebellion in heaven and all of those things. I want you to understand that. But the Bible talks about Jesus destroying the devil. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 says, Jesus came to destroy the devil. That doesn't mean annihilate now. It means to ruin the devil and to take away him from him a power that he had over mankind, and that is the fear of death. So Jesus came, went into the Hadean world, went into the grave, and he came out. The devil didn't have any control of it. Jesus, the book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 18 says, he has the keys to Hades. And so up until Jesus escapes the grave, nobody had ever escaped it. Some had been raised, but they died again. The ultimate power over mankind is death, and Jesus escaped that. Now then, Hebrews 2:14 says he destroyed the devil. Doesn't mean he's not like a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour, but the devil is bound. That's what the book of Revelation says. Doesn't have the power that he used to have, nor does he have the allies that he once had to fight against Christianity. Now, having said all of that, Colossians chapter 2, verse 14 says, he blotted out the handwriting of ordinances, verse 14, that was contrary to us, and he's taken out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. Now, we got the death of Christ, having disarmed principalities and powers. Now, I have no idea what principalities and powers he disarmed if it's not the devil. He disarmed principalities and powers. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it, and that is in the cross. in the cross and in his death and in his resurrection, he disarmed principalities and powers. Now, having said that, look back in Colossians chapter 1 that says, where is that? Yes. Verse 15, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, invisible things and visible things, whether thrones or dominions or principalities and powers, all things were created through him and for him. And so if the principalities and powers in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15 has reference to the disarming of Satan, then chapter 1 says that they were created, principalities and powers created. Yes, Dave, speak loud. Well, it depends on how you take all things were good. It might be they're good for the purpose for which he made them. That may be what is included in that. And that's why, I know the concept of there is the concept that before God created Adam and Eve, there's another whole world, and Satan came down, the angels came down and had sex with people that were on this earth, and there was a rebellion against heaven, and they came down and tried to establish their domain on this earth. You may not have heard all of that. But there is that concept, and all I'm saying is let's get back and look at what the text says. I believe that this verse, Colossians chapter 2, verse 4 to verse 15, and chapter 1, verse 15, in my mind, help us understand help us understand about this matter. If the principalities and powers in 2:15 include the devil, and I don't know how you can exclude the devil, then chapter 1, verse 16 says they were created by God. And so that's where I am. Now then, Deuteronomy 29:29. Anybody in this room know Deuteronomy 29:29? Best verse in the Bible to answer a Bible question. All right, so several of you know that verse. The things that are revealed belong to us, but secret things belong to God. And I'm content in my mind and in my Bible to study to say, I don't know about that. I'm not sure about that. I don't have to answer every question. As Brother Camp used to say, if God didn't see fit to answer all that for you, why are you worried about it? Now, that doesn't mean I'm not going to study it and make sure I've found everything in relationship that I can find. Let's get to chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the consequences of sin. Genesis chapter 3, the consequences of sin. Sin's been brought into the world. Adam and Eve have disobeyed God. Now, what are the consequences of that sin? Well, you begin looking at it, and there is that serpent that is going to crawl on the earth on his belly. I have no idea what he was like before, and you don't either. You've all seen the picture of the temptation, right? The drawings of the temptation. Adam and Eve in the garden. Here's Eve looking at the fruit. Where is that snake? He's just like a regular snake, just slithering around up in that tree. That's not the nature of that serpent before this. In fact, chapter 3 talks about how cunning the serpent was. He was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord had made. Isn't that remarkable? Here is this snake, and he's more cunning. He is a level above all of the other things that God's made. And what he looks like, Deuteronomy 29:29 will tell you exactly what he looks like, okay? How tall was he? Deuteronomy 29:29 will tell you how tall. What color was he? Deuteronomy 29:29. What do I know about that serpent? More cunning than anything that God had made. And so here is that serpent, and because of that serpent's part in this temptation, he says, on your belly, verse 14, chapter 3, verse 14, you shall go and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And so there is that that curse that is placed upon that servant. Then there is the curse that is mentioned in the next verse that's placed upon the devil himself. Look in verse 15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. There are two or three things about this. First of all, the fact that verse 15 talks about the seed being in the woman. That's really, really weird, because the seed is not in the woman until it's implanted there by the male. And yet there was that one individual who was the seed of woman, and that is Jesus. And so it's interesting, there is a change. Go back to verse 15. I will put enmity between you and the woman. What is the antecedent of you? Who is the antecedent of you? Do we need to talk about antecedent? Is that seventh grade? What's an antecedent? It's the pronoun, and a pronoun's antecedent is the noun nearest to that pronoun. You know, David and Sky went to the mall, and they, at least one of them, had a good time. Now, what's the antecedent of they? You just go back and look at the nearest pronoun. So the antecedent of you, God's talking to the serpent, you'll crawl on your belly, and I will put enmity, you know what that is, between you and the woman. Why are women afraid of snakes? I'm not saying any men love snakes, but I just find that interesting in and of itself. If you are a woman and you like snakes, you are weird, you know. So here, from the very beginning, the antecedent of the you, between that thing slithering on the ground, you know, and you women could break a 4-minute mile if there are just snakes all around the tracks, right? And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between her seed, or between your seed and her seed. I will put enmity between your descendants and her descendants. And then all of a sudden, it shall bruise your head. Not that the descendants, all of the children of Eve, were going to bruise the head of the serpent, but it singular shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Isn't that amazing? Look at Romans chapter 16, verse 20, where this language it helps us understand that it has a New Testament application. And Romans chapter 16, verse 20, and the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. So here is the crushing of Satan. And so here is this very imagery of Satan being crushed. By whom was he crushed? By he whose foot he hurt. And then as he was, figuratively speaking, biting the foot of Jesus, Jesus stomped on his head. That's exactly, and that's what Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 and 15 says. He came to destroy him. Revelation chapter 20 says he bound him for 1,000 years. So Satan was bruised. But it was not the heel of Satan that was bruised, but it was the head of Satan. Now back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Isn't that remarkable? When I read that verse, I think about something changed, didn't it? Suppose they'd had children in the Garden of Eden. If the Lord's going to multiply your pain in childbirth, what about childbirth before the curse? What about Deuteronomy 29:29? The multiplying of the pain is indicative of the fact that something changed. What that was before this curse, I don't know. But it's implied, isn't it? Prior to this time, the pain of childbirth is not what it was after this time. Now, you women, most of you women will understand this, and that is the very pain of childbirth is God's way of reminding the tragedy of sin. Sometimes we never associate that. We never really recognize that this is a reminder in the lives of all mothers and all husbands who are out playing golf while their wives are in labor. It is a reminder to them of the consequence of sin. Now, is there a reminder to the man? Absolutely. Verse 17 says, you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of life, of which I command you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. The expression, you'll earn your bread by the sweat of your brow, is not a Bible verse, but have you heard that expression? Is that just a good Southern expression? Have you heard of that? You'll earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. Where does that come from? You come home and you're absolutely dead tired from having worked. That will be a reminder. God put on this earth for men and for women a reminder of the consequences of sins. Now there's another reminder. Go back to verse 16. It says, your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. Underscore the word rule and recognize that is not a master-slave kind of relationship. It has to do with the desire that a wife has for her husband. Don't you think it's rather remarkable that almost never does the Bible tells wives to love their husbands? I mean, how many verses in the Bible can you think of that tells the wife to love their husband? Isn't that remarkable? And yet, think of the verses in the Bible that says, husbands, love your wives. Inherently, because of what happened in the Garden of Eden, was God placed within a woman a desire for her husband. Let me ask you this. Who is the most tolerant of infidelity in a marriage? Who is the most tolerant of a good-for-nothing mate in a marriage? And the answer is obvious, isn't it? Women are far more tolerant. I just don't know how she can put up with him. And that comes out of this verse here. Your desire shall be for your husband. I find that rather remarkable. The old King James talks about the old King James talks. I don't want to go there. That's chasing a rabbit, and we'll get over there and stay over there forever. But the Bible talked about Cain desiring his brother. I grew up as a baby in the family, having desired to have the favor of my big brother. That's over the next chapter in reference to Cain and Abel. And that really helped me understand your desire shall be for your husband. Longing to have the favor. And every husband in this audience ought to be ashamed of themselves if they do not brag on their wives and compliment their wives every way possible. Why? Because she has a desire for her husband. Men, you're missing out on a golden opportunity to enhance your marriage beyond all measure. I have no idea what it was like before the Garden of Eden. I really don't have any desire. But as a consequence of sin entering in the world, there is that desire within that wife for her husband. She does. She longs to have his favor, longs to please him. The Bible has to say to us, it's not good that man should be alone. But we understand that about wives because women desire to have a man in their life. Now, that doesn't mean if you're not married, doesn't mean that you're weird or anything at all like that anymore than anything. But as a result of what happened in the Garden of Eden, your desire should be to your husband. Isn't that remarkable? If you just read it, back away from it and say, what does this text say? The text says, I'll multiply your children, your pain in childbearing. What does that imply? Probably implies a change. And then he says, and your desire shall be to your husband. And there is a place of authority in our culture that comes out of the Garden of Eden. And back away, not in our culture, but there's a place in the Bible that comes as a result of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 14 talks about the role of women in the church. And he says, verse 34, 1 Corinthians 14, 34, let your women keep silence in the church, for they're not permitted to speak. They are but commanded to be submissive, as also the law states. So here's the reference to the Old Testament. And the Old Testament law says there is, as a result of what happened in the Garden of Eden, there is a place, listen, not of worth, but a place of the orderliness of society. And so he says, they are to be submissive, as also the law states. So there's the Old Testament statement in as we read in Genesis and other places, and now there's a New Testament application of that very same thing. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 2. As a result of what happened in the Garden of Eden, Paul says, "This is that which I do not permit." Chapter 2, verse 12. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over the man, but to be in silence because, and look at this, because Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Why is it that you cannot have women preachers? Why is it that you cannot not have women teaching over a man in the church? It's not a cultural thing. It's not something, well, that's the way it was in the first century, and the statements in relationship to the role of women is a first century cultural thing, and it only reflects what's happened in the culture. These two verses, two passages, say nothing at all about the cultural aspect of it. It ties it back to the statement in Genesis chapter 3, your desire shall be to your husband and he shall rule over you. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And you've got the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Whenever he says, I want you to know, verse 3, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. The head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. So there's God, and then there's the Christ, and there's the man, and there's the woman. Well, what's this all about? Well, go down to verse 11. Says, she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Let's see. Verse 8. For man is not from the woman, but the woman from the man. Now he's talking about this matter of authority in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And he says, man is not from the woman, but the woman from the man. What was man made out of? Dust. What was Eve made out of? Adam's rib. She came out of the man. And that's the argumentation. And that is tied to the creation. Verse 9. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. That goes back to Genesis chapter 3. To the statement in Genesis chapter 3. Now in verse 11, Paul counterbalances this when he says, Nevertheless, neither is man independent of the woman, nor woman independent of man independent of man in the Lord. For as a woman came from man, even so man also comes through a woman. So he balances it out, and we need to understand that this, all we're talking about is the orderliness of society. Why is it that in the church you do not have women elders? Is that a cultural thing? Is that a male chauvinistic thing? Well, not in reality. Because one of the qualifications of an elder is he's to be what? Of one wife? The husband of one wife. That in and of itself. But whenever Paul says, I do not suffer a woman to have authority over the man. Eldership's a place of authority. I don't suffer a woman to have authority over the man. And all of that has to do with a reminder of what happened in the Garden of Eden. I remember my first child, Debbie. She came to me one time. She said, Daddy, said, I want to be a preacher. Do you think they'll ever change the Bible so I can preach? She loved her daddy, and I think And so she says, you know, you think they'll ever change? Listen to what she said, change the Bible. At that age, she knew what the Bible said. And so having said all of this, I'm not talking chauvinistically. I may be a male chauvinist, but not one word have I said that indicates male chauvinism. We've looked at verses in the Bible where God places restrictions and causes society to function in the roles in which individuals play. Ever been pulled over by a policeman? You know, is he less than you? He probably is a wife beater. He probably is an atrocious kind of person. Probably is all of that. You're probably a whole lot better person he ever thought about being. You going to obey him? Why? Because he's better than you? Absolutely not. Because God says, obey them that have the authority over you. Because God says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. And talking about civil government in Romans chapter 13. For society to exist, you've got to have order. Now you think about that in a classroom situation. You got to have somebody in charge. So you're involved in Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. You got to have pecking order there for anything to function. You know, and so that has nothing at all to do with all that has to do with is the orderliness of society. But in spiritual matters, husbands, love your wives and love your wives like Christ loved the church. And he gave, the Greek says, he gave himself up for her. What that means? It means, Mike, you got to give yourself up for Julie. That's tough, isn't it? But in that, that's what it says. I mean, I don't know why I picked on Mike. Yeah, but you understand. You understand what that means? It's not, well, he's a whole lot better than you. Christ laid down everything he had for his wife. And yet, in order for society to exist, wives, submit yourself to the husbands as unto the Lord. And so all of this comes out of Genesis 3. All right, I've talked for the last 12, 20 minutes or every minute. What comments do you have? Yes, Richard. Speak loud. I believe that's right. I believe that's right. What are the comments? Absolutely, Richard. Thanks for your comments. Yes, Gary. All right. What if a man's not following God's truth? What if civil government does not follow God's truth? There's a principle involved, isn't it? In Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5, civil government told the apostles that you cannot preach at all in the name of Jesus. And the apostles there says, we ought to obey God rather than man. And so, same thing about children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. What about if your parents are trying to get you to do wrong? We ought to obey God rather than man. And so, I should have let somebody else comment about that. What other comments anybody have? Anything anybody want to say? Yes, Pete. Pat. Great, absolutely. Did you hear that? With that authority, that great authority comes great responsibility. You better believe it. You know what the Bible says? The Bible places upon fathers the responsibility of teaching their children about God. How's that for responsibility? I mean, you stop and think about it. The Bible, the verse that talks about bringing your children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, the audience specifically addressed is that father who's the head of the house. If your children don't know the Bible, guess whose fault it is? Guess who has fallen away from God's plan? Your fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Bring them up in the teaching and the admonition of the Lord. There's that authority. And let me just say this. It might help you in relationship to your children, grandchildren sometimes. I try to tell our young people and every time I get a chance that the one person you marry on this earth ought to be the one person that will help you go to heaven and the one person that will give you greater joy of taking to heaven with you. If the purpose of your marriage is to help each other go to heaven, this matter of riches and poor and better and worse and sickness and health is meaningless. Why? Purpose of this marriage is to help each other get to heaven. And that to me is some of the soundest advice that that can be found anywhere, is that you need to marry somebody to help you go to heaven. Otherwise, not just somebody that every Sunday there's a crisis in your life. And it doesn't mean you're not married. If you marry somebody who's not a Christian, it doesn't mean that that God doesn't make that a holy marriage. It is holy matrimony. But it's if you really want to have happiness in your marriage, then if the husband is subject to Christ and the wife is subject to Christ, when something comes up, there's only one question to answer. Not what do I want, not what does you want, what does God want? Makes all the difference in the world. Now, for most of us, that's way, way beyond us, but we do have grandchildren, don't we? And so we need to keep that in mind, is that the Bible talks about the husband nourishing and cherishing his wife. You hear that? Now, here's this man that's going to rule over his wife. What does God tell him to do? You cherish her. That word cherish is used with the word tenderness, and it's like the warmth of the sun that melts butter. You cherish your wife. And the nourishment, when we think of nourishment, we think of, well, I got to go out and get some food for this house. That's right. To nourish her means to provide physically for her in reference to food, but to provide for her spiritually. She needs spiritual nourishment. And husbands need to understand that they have a responsibility to be the spiritual head of that house. Now, I know women are better at it than men. And I know I don't have to talk to wives about nourishing your home. If you have a spiritual home, it's probably because of the wife and mother that's in there. But the responsibility is on that husband. And then there is that emotional nourishment. Does anybody ever notice that women are sometimes, maybe once every 5 years or so, are rather emotional women? You know, they've got to have a shoulder that they can cry on. You know, it's about once every 5 years. Chris, you hadn't been married for quite 5 years. But sometime within the first 5 years of your marriage, Brittany's going to need somebody to shoulders to cry on. Let me tell you, husbands, you'd better be that shoulder. That's the nourishment that she needs. And that's what Pat was talking about the greater responsibility. Headship is not, well, woman, I'm the head of this house, and this is what we're going to do. I want new golf clubs, and that settles it. You know, that's not headship. It's nourishing and cherishing and in reference to all of these things. You know, you have reference to all of these things. Verse 20, back in chapter 3. And Adam called his wife's name Eve because, why did he call her Eve? She was the mother of a lot of folks that lived on this earth. She was the mother of all the living. You've got to stick that in the back of your head, because next week we're going to talk about where Cain got his wife. You know, the Bible talks about Cain getting a wife, and next week we're going to talk about where Cain got his wife. But you just heard the answer. If there's another race of people on this earth, then Eve is not the mother of all the living. All right, we've got to cover 50 chapters, and we're 4 weeks into a 20-week studies, and we're in not even to chapter 4. We got to speed it up, and we intend to speed it up, because some of the other chapters have got some good material in it. We're going to rather rush through several of them.